This is WMUK's Let's Hear It, Music of the Moment in West Michigan. I'm Kara Lawrence. Glad you could join me tonight. The Kalamazoo Junior Symphony Orchestra presents a concert this Sunday at 4 o'clock in Chenery Auditorium, a concert called Cinematic. And once again, my guest is music director Andrew Kohler. And it's so nice to see you here, as always. But Andrew, I wonder if your presence may be somewhat superfluous, as the concert includes this theme. I think that's going to put people in seats.
I sure hope so. It certainly has gotten the orchestra excited, I'll tell you that right now. When I announced the season last summer still, we programmed all kinds of exciting things for this year. We did a Franck symphony, and despite all of that, all anyone was talking about was Star Wars. We're going to do Star Wars. And I'm no less excited, I've got to be honest. I was absolutely one of those kids who grew up with those films and who has had that music in his ear for as long as I can remember. I think, I'm in fact quite sure my mother has admitted to me that she thought something might be wrong with me, because when I was a kid, I had sort of memorized the place in the video store. There were still video stores when I was a kid, where Return of the Jedi was. And I, you know, we would just go to the video store, and time again, I would just run to that part, that aisle. I knew exactly what it was. I can even remember sliding in there as if it were home base in a baseball game, and grabbing that video that I loved and nearly wore out till my parents finally broke down and just bought it and figured, okay, this is obviously something he won't stop watching. But she was seriously concerned, because, you know, what child would want to see something so many times? I think it's actually quite normal. But
it is kind of normal.
But at the time, she was a little worried. It did seem a bit excessive, because I just loved those films so much.
I miss the fact that you could wear out media. In the
right.
old days.
Exactly so. Yeah. My parents did end up buying the original Star Wars then, which had been out for many years. That came out shortly before I was born. But, you know, they bought one of the first VHS cassettes you could get. You know, it even comes in this. We still have it at home. It's still in this weird box. But yeah, we tried to watch it, I don't know, maybe 5 or 6 years ago again. And you can really see, I mean, it's really disintegrated. It's just not what it used to be anymore. But boy, I love those films, and I certainly love that music. And I think for any of us, a big part of the enjoyment of those films is the music itself. And I think that's what it comes down to. That's really what this whole concert is about.
Well, John Williams is no slouch as a composer and as an orchestrator. He's very demanding, or the people who orchestrate for him. I understand he's more of a factory than a composer in some ways.
Oh, that's interesting, because I'd actually heard, I mean, I don't really know the ins and outs of the business, but I'd actually heard that as far as Hollywood goes, John Williams is one of the most hands-on guys out there. I mean, that he's really doing most of the heavy lifting himself. At least that was my impression. But I don't know. Either way, it ends up awfully good.
Well, why don't we start with the full program and give people an idea of everything coming up on Sunday?
Sure. Our program will begin with music by Shostakovich, who actually began his career, in a sense, playing keyboard instruments in movie theaters in the Soviet Union. So he, this was, of course, in the era of silent films, and he was sort of improvisational keyboard player there, and would make up some scores on the spot in certain cases to accompany these new films. And so once it became possible to record full scores and just sync them with the films, you know, that talkies and films with scores were possible, he was obviously a natural choice. And of course, in the Soviet Union, this was a medium that was thought as having a real mass appeal, quite naturally. And so that was something that the socialist government would want to push. So we begin with really wonderful music that he wrote to this 1955 film called The Gadfly, or in Russian, Ovodya. And after that, we have our concerto competition winner, a young man named Zachary Brandon, who's quite extraordinary, playing, you know, and it's quite amazing, because I can't necessarily determine who will win the concerto competition. But it just so happened that he won this year, and that what he wanted to play was the Waxman Carmen Fantasy, and it just so happens that that comes from a film. So, I mean, it was kismet. It was perfect. It fits exactly with our program here. It was a film called Humoresque, and it was about a sort of aspiring violinist, and this was one of the showpieces that the violinist plays.
John Garfield?
Right, I think so. within the film. And it's just a dazzling thing, and Zachary just plays it so incredibly well. I think anyone will be amazed. And then, as we've already mentioned, we'll finish our afternoon with Star Wars.
Well, why don't we? What I have queued up here is the Carmen Fantasy, and Humoresque is the source film that it was written for. Franz Waxman should be acknowledged as one of the pioneers of film music in the golden age of Hollywood.
That's absolutely the case. Yeah, he was right up there with the really maybe somewhat more famous names, the Bernard Herrmanns and Korngolds. And he was a incredible composer, really, really gifted, thoroughly trained. Another one of those Central European emigres that ended up in Hollywood. And he worked with Hitchcock several times. He won 2 Academy Awards. Scored countless films. And this is really in a remarkable tradition, because this is not the only Carmen Fantasy out there. For many listeners who know the violin repertoire, they might think immediately of Pablo de Sarasate, who was himself a 19th century virtuoso violinist, and who did a very sort of typical thing for those 19th century virtuosos, and that is to say, to string together a medley of tunes from a beloved opera and just make it a sort of vehicle for virtuosity on their instrument. That dates all the way back to even Chopin. One of the first pieces that Schumann thought marked Chopin's genius was a series of variations on La Ci Darem la Mano from Don Giovanni. And, you know, that tradition just kept going throughout the 19th century. And so Sarasate wrote his own Carmen Fantasy, which is in its own right really spectacular. But Waxman seemingly took it to an even more virtuosic level. I mean, I joke because it's sort of with Zachary, I joke about this, that it's the Waxman Carmen Fantasy is the piece you play if you think the Sarasate Fantasy is a little too easy. It's just not, it's lacking somehow in fireworks.
And why would he do this?
Why would he do a thing like this? I suppose it's like Everest, because he can, you know, because it's there. And he just has such a extraordinary technique, and he can pull it off. And it's just a real showstopper in an afternoon full of showstoppers.
Now, why would Franz Waxman decide to make an even more difficult arrangement of Carmen?
Well, so he's writing for this film, of course. He's writing about a young aspiring violinist who wants to make his mark on the world. So he has to have something that I think really portrays this violinist's extraordinary ability. And as the story goes, when he was initially considering who he wanted to play this in the film, he wanted to have Jascha Heifetz play it. And Jascha Heifetz is certainly I think many would argue perhaps the greatest violinist of the 20th century. I mean, just an extraordinary talent.
The one guy that could give Pablo de Sarasate a run for his money.
Precisely so, yeah. Unfortunately, apparently, the way things worked out, Heifetz might have been a little too asked for a little bit too much money, and the studios balked. So they ended up with someone from the younger generation who wasn't very well known at the time, but in the end they did all right. It was Isaac Stern who actually ended up playing it in the film. Nonetheless, Heifetz still liked the piece a lot and took it on tour with him and played it in recitals constantly. So even though Waxman didn't quite have his dream of having Heifetz being the violinist who plays it in the film, Heifetz did play it and recorded it, and I think we're going to get a chance to listen to some of Heifetz's extraordinary virtuosity on display in this Carmen Fantasy.
After we listen to this fantasy, we'll talk a little more about Zachary Brandon and the rest of the program, Cinematic, which is set to be held on Sunday at 4 o'clock in Chenery Auditorium, led by my guest, music director Andrew Kohler. ¶¶ Well, in 1950s mono technology, we just heard Yasha Heifetz burning up The Carmen Fantasy by Franz Waxman. Andrew Kohler is my guest, music director of the Kalamazoo Junior Symphony. And a performance of that very virtuosic piece is set for Sunday at 4 o'clock. So tell me about soloist Zachary Brandon.
There are a limited number of people in the world who can play something like the Waxman Carmen Fantasy that we were just listening to. And the crazy thing is that Zachary has such a technique to burn. I mean, he must have... I bet if somebody did a study, they would find a far higher concentration of fast twitch nerve fibers or something in somebody like Zachary Brandon. I tell you, I think he plays it even faster than Heifetz just did at the end there. The orchestra honestly has trouble keeping up with him. He can play this stuff so fast. He just goes at it. But
is it fakeable? I've known some pieces in my repertoire are kind of fakeable.
He's not faking it. He's really not. I mean, it goes so fast. It's faster than I can really tell you honestly whether or not it's there or not. No, but Zachary is a tremendous talent. I mean, really, really amazing. And the thing that is important to mention here is that this is the second time that he's won our concerto competition. Now, Zachary became one of the youngest ever members of the orchestra years ago. He was still, I want to say something like 10 years old, I think. And in that year, he won the concerto competition. And he just, of course, looked like what a 10-year-old would look like. He was an adorable little boy, did wonderfully. He played the finale of the Kabalevsky Concerto, if I recall. And then, you know, he left the orchestra for a few years. I think he wanted to really concentrate. His heart is really, I think, in soloistic playing in many senses. So he was concentrating on that. He's been taking lessons in Chicago and now starting to study with Almida Vamos, a very famous pedagogue. And he's decided this year that he wanted to return to the orchestra. And, of course, we were delighted to have him back. And he's grown up. He's a freshman now, I think. I'm pretty sure he's a freshman in high school. And he's... you know, looks like a young man as opposed to a little boy when we last knew him. But certainly his talent has continued to grow in tandem with his height. So it's really nice to see him back amongst our ranks and playing with this newfound maturity, but still with just as much astonishing technique and ease and just sort of natural soloistic instincts. That's really what it comes down to in a way. Certainly he plays really wonderfully, but there's certain aspects of solo playing that don't come naturally to some people. Things like the amount of sound that you have to produce, you know, just how much you have to push the sound into the hall and fight against the sound of an entire orchestra, right? Because there's so many other people who, yes, we will work hard to be quiet enough to make way for you, but still a soloist must really announce his presence on the stage. And Zachary just gets that really intuitively.
Zachary Brandon will be the soloist in this concert at 4 o'clock in Chenery Auditorium, which is the Kalamazoo Junior Symphony Orchestra's music home here in Kalamazoo, and a beautiful facility it is. Tickets and more information are available online at kalamazoojuniorsymphony.com. You can find out more there. Tickets will be available at the door.
They sure will.
Well, moving on to the Shostakovich suite, you said this was from 55.
That's right.
Right? This movie called The Gadfly. I have a very fuzzy idea of what a gadfly might be. I think it's a gentleman who's maybe not that trustworthy or...
My sense is that the gadfly refers to someone who is able to sort of poke at... a larger entity. And this is exactly what this film is about. And the film is based on a 19th century novel. And that it's a British novel by a woman named Ethel Voynich, who has a last name which suggests some sort of Russian ancestry. But she was herself British. And her novel is set earlier still in the mid-19th century, in Italy, in the Risorgimento. So strangely enough, you wouldn't think this would be the sort of thing you might expect in a Soviet context, but this is a wildly popular novel. And it'll be, I think it'll make sense in a second why this was so popular. So the story essentially is about a young man named Arthur. And Arthur is part of the underground revolution, the Risorgimento in Italy, that wanted to throw off the yoke of the Habsburg Empire and unite Italy under one Italian ruler. And in this struggle, we learn a couple things about Arthur as a person. One is that he seemingly has no parents, but has a kindly priest who looks after him. In point of fact, that kindly priest is his biological father, but he doesn't realize this at the beginning. And of course, as a Catholic priest, his biological father cannot really reveal this secret, this indiscretion of his past. What ends up happening is that he's deeply religious at the beginning of this novel, and he confesses in a Catholic church that he's part of this underground movement. But that confession, which should be, of course, never repeated by the priest, is in fact revealed, this is a different priest, revealed to the Habsburg authorities. And in consequence, Arthur is arrested. The love of his life, who's a fellow revolutionary, thinks he's a traitor to the cause, and he's obviously deeply hurt by this. He suffers a loss of faith because he's put so much into this Catholic faith, and then they betray him in a sense because they're allied with the Habsburg troops. He fakes his own suicide and disappears. And then the novel just sort of breaks off there for a little bit. And he has these terrible and unspecified adventures in South America. And he comes back years later, disfigured. He's had some sort of physical fights, and who knows? It's only vaguely alluded to in the novel. Comes back to Italy and then sort of leads the movement and becomes known as the Gadfly because he's publishing anti-Habsburg screeds, anti-clerical screeds in the newspapers. He's actually going and fighting at you know, troop checkpoints and shooting some of the Habsburg troops when necessary, when things get really rough. So he's, in other words, this small one organism that's somehow managing to sting over and over again this much larger body. In the end, he does find out the truth about his father, and he's arrested again, and he begs his father to reveal the fact that he is indeed his son, because he thinks that's the only thing that might spare him execution. His father hesitates, can't quite bring himself to do it. He's become a very important cardinal by this point, and Arthur is executed. And but before doing so, he leaves a note to his beloved Gemma. This is the woman he's in love with, his fellow revolutionary, and prophesizes the future success of their movement, which indeed happened. Italy was eventually successfully unified and threw off the Habsburg yoke.
Well, if you just tuned in, we're not talking about a Victor Hugo novel, but something along those lines.
Very much so.
A very mid-19th century, that was set in the mid-19th century, but written in the early 20th?
Actually, very late 19th, yeah, just around the cusp of the beginning of the 20th.
And a story that moved the Russian people.
And you can imagine why, right? I mean, we have the two twin themes of revolution, right? The need for constant revolution, the need to do whatever it takes to make that revolution happen. And, of course, the anti-clericalism, the anti-Catholic sort of sentiment, the anti-religious sentiment, both of which were the foundational pillars of communism.
Shostakovich set this story to music for a film. Have you seen any of this film?
I've seen the film and I read the novel because I just became so excited about this music and so interested in it that when I was getting to know it, I decided to look at both to understand it better. And the film is quite wonderfully done. It's by a director named Feinz Zimmer, very German sounding name, but he was a Russian director. The interesting thing for me about this film is that, you know, truth be told, sometimes Shostakovich, who wrote over 130 film scores, if you can believe it, you know, we don't think of him necessarily as a film composer, but he wrote many of these. When compared to someone like Prokofiev, for example, who is his contemporary, Shostakovich seemed often like when he was doing things like film scores or having to write propaganda pieces that he let's be honest, phoned it in a little bit, you can say, right? I mean, that he really lavished all his personal genius on the string quartets, on the symphonies, on the pieces that he really cared about, and then was such a fluent composer that he could, you know, take care of writing a piece for something like a movie, even if he didn't necessarily invest all of his energy in it. It seems to me like The Gadfly is not among those works. Like there's something about The Gadfly where he really invested more of himself in this music. And I wonder, I can't help but wonder, I should say, if it has something to do with the fact that 1955 would have been very shortly after Stalin died. And one of the pieces that he produced, concert pieces that he produced very early after Stalin's death, is called the Festive Overture, which was in itself a kind of political statement because it is the cheeriest, most excited piece that Shostakovich ever wrote. Just unabashed, you know, 8 minutes of rollicking fun, which in the wake of a death is a tricky thing to pull off. But what's interesting to me is that there is a folk, a sort of gathering of the folk in this movie, and a movement called the Folk Feast. And it seems to me like a study for the Festive Overture. It shares a lot of not only its energy, but certain even passages in it that are in common.
That's a terrific moment from The Gadfly, a film score most of us don't know anything about, but Shostakovich is in a particularly festive mood right there.
Absolutely, yeah, and I can't, as I said, because it bears such a striking resemblance to the Festive Overture, which again was a concert piece that he wrote after Stalin's death, I'm not sure, I can't pin down or find enough information to know exactly what months, I mean, we're talking months here, you know, which one would have come first to know for sure, but certainly seems like the two were, you know, sort of came out of the same embryo, as it were. And that's a great example in the score of music that illustrates a particular scene. Also, I think shows Shostakovich's willingness to sort of channel Italian operatic aesthetic even. You know, there's that one passage, dum ba-dum, 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 which sounds like it could be in a spaghetti commercial or something like that. I mean, it really feels sort of almost eye-rollingly Italian, but in a really fun way. So he's certainly willing to do this. There are also other moments where he illustrates, you know, wealthy socialites dancing with a contra dance. But naturally, there's also music in here that illustrates the tone of the larger story. One example would just be to listen to the opening title, which is in the suite called The Overture. And I think that does a great job of communicating the kind of stoic resolve of our hero.
I would like to mention once again that the concert is this Sunday at 4 o'clock in Chenery Auditorium, the Kalamazoo Junior Symphony Orchestra, filled with wonderful young musicians, playing a program called Cinematic. Tickets available at the door or look online at kalamazoojuniorsymphony.com. Let's hear the overture, but I did have one question. Film music is meant to accompany a film. It takes a good score to create a suite, a standalone concert suite. Now, does this stand up in that way? Is it filled with enough interest and variety to make good standalone music?
I would not have programmed it if it didn't, to be honest. And you're very right to say that there are often sometimes film, what a film requires of a composer is something that must necessarily be play a secondary role. It may create atmosphere that will be terribly effective for the film, but if you listen to it by itself without some sort of visual medium accompanying it, you might feel that something is lacking. There's not enough a dramatic narrative in it. That's not the case here. And in addition, this particular suite was prepared by a Soviet musicologist named Lev Atomian. And in consequence, what he's done is he takes certain sections of music and then basically hybridizes them into ABA kinds of formats. So, you know, you might recognize, if you know the film, that some of these movements begin with, say, music that depicts the church, but then in the middle has a dramatic scene from his loss of faith, you know, but then goes back to that music from the church. So you feel a kind of natural musical structure. We have something, we go to something else, we return to something else. That's the format that so many of our movements follow. But the arranger has done this in a very artful way, I would argue, and in such a way to make sure that there is maximal interest in a concert presentation of this music.
How many movements are there in this suite?
There are 12 total movements, although I will say that I thought that three of them maybe didn't quite rise to the level that I was just describing of the rest. And so I've made the choice for various reasons to shorten the suite a little bit. So we will be presenting 9 of the 12.
And one of them is this overture.
Exactly so.
That's from The Gadfly by Dmitri Shostakovich. We heard the overture in a more laid-back version, I think, than you're planning, Andrew. It's so fun to watch conductors hear other recordings.
And bristle at the outrage that is someone else thinking of it in a different way. Yeah. Well, I mean, with all due respect to Mr. Cerebri, for me, that movement, that overture kind of encapsulates the stoic energy of this character. And that seemed maybe a little bit sleepy. So we'll be doing it a bit more energetically.
You'll be aghast to learn that this suite on this recording takes 45 minutes to play.
Actually, that is not atypical, but that's a little on the long side, yeah. We will be shorter than that, I promise.
Okay. The concert is called Cinematic, and it starts at 4 o'clock on Sunday at Chenery Auditorium and features the Kalamazoo Junior Symphony, filled with wonderful musicians. I'm actually looking forward to playing with in this Noah's Flood performance coming up this weekend. Cullen O'Neill is there, Maisie Snyder, wonderful players.
Some of our leading lights there, yes.
Yeah, I think you're quite fortunate in having a strong group.
I sure am.
Let's see, what have we left for last?
Well, there's one natural choice. I mean, someone asked me the other day, what is the program order? And I said, if you've got Star Wars on your program, you don't not end with Star Wars, if you'll excuse the double negative there. So yes, indeed, we are ending with Star Wars. And I had, you know, I don't know if you saw this making the rounds online a little while ago. Maybe some of your listeners have. But there's this incredible thing called Star Wars Minus Williams. And what they do is they show the throne room scene from the end of episode 4. And it's just a clever little trick. They just take out all the music. And for those of you who might remember the throne room scene, it's where, you know, Chewbacca and Han Solo and Luke are walking down this long promenade and get medals handed to them by Princess Leia at the end.
It's the end of the movie.
It's the end of the movie.
Celebrating
but it's
each other.
Incredibly stirring. And you think, oh, this is such exciting stuff. And what they've done is they've taken out the music, that John Williams' incredible march there. He takes the Force theme, the da-dee-da-da-da-dee-da, and he turns it into a march. And in that scene, it's so incredibly exciting and viscerally thrilling. And when they remove it, you suddenly realize that this, based just on the visuals alone, seems just patently ridiculous. It's so silly. You just think, why are they all just standing there smiling at each other like that? It's horrendously awkward to watch.
It's one of the most static scenes you'd ever
watch. Exactly, right. I mean, it's totally dull. You can't imagine it. And it's then that it dawns on you just how much of an effect this music has. How much of our notion, when we think of the word cinematic, we think, oh, grandeur, sweep, you know, this incredible canvas. But really, I think a lot of it is wrapped up in the music, and nothing proves that more than listening to something like the music to the throne room.
Well, Andrew, it's a pleasure to talk to you as always, and have a great time on your concert this Sunday at 4 o'clock.
I'm sure that I will. Thank you so much, Kara.
There you go. That's the throne room and end title from the Star Wars suite, music of John Williams. And a full suite is on the program this Sunday at 4 o'clock from the Kalamazoo Junior Symphony Orchestra, ending its wonderful 2014-2015 season in Chenery Auditorium with music of Shostakovich and Waxman's Carmen Fantasy, also on the program, featuring the concerto competition winner Zachary Brandon. That's all at 4 o'clock Sunday afternoon, led by today's guest, Andrew Kohler. I'm Kara Lawrence. Thanks for tuning in to WMUK's Let's Hear It, Music of the Moment in West Michigan.